What is it, Sheriff? You seem down.
Well, Deputy Sergeant, it's just that the fine people of this good town keep disappearing. Something is getting them. It saddens me that I can't figure out who or what's doing it.
Do you have any leads?
I keep thinking it might be connected to the ice cream shop. Or the library. Maybe that squinty-eyed librarian. I don't know. I got this bad feeling about her.
What about that mysterious plant on the edge of town?
You mean Glencore Blackwater Treadstone, a highly secretive corporation accountable to no one? I don't think so, Deputy Sergeant. They seem like real nice, decent folks. They're always so polite, and, you know, I feel bad for them because all the protective equipment they always got to wear.
Yeah, but it's right there in their name. Glencore Bridgewater Treadstone, a highly secretive corporation accountable to no one.
I think that's just some, what do they call it, like a branding thing. It don't mean no, never mind.
But they have those big signs up all along the perimeter fence. Do not trespass. Sticky monsters loose on premises.
Well, that's just it, ain't it, Deputy Sergeant? I mean, if they had anything to do with these awful disappearances, would they be so upfront and honest about all the sticky monsters they got? Whereas the Presbyterian Church in town, nobody knows what goes on in there.
Yeah, but the plan...
Now, I'm gonna stop you right there. When you've been a policeman as long as I have, you get kind of a... what is it called? It's like an instinct for people, and these are real nice folks.
Well, if you say so.
You'll see, Deputy Sergeant. You'll make a fine policeman yet.
Oh, I'm not a police officer. My mother watched a lot of mystery shows when she was pregnant, so she named me Deputy Sergeant. Deputy Sergeant Trumblebuffer.
Oh, well, then where do you work?
At the big gated industrial complex the next town over. Human Dismemberment Associates.
And what is it you folks do?
We make cuckoo clocks.
That's swell. I love those little things. Hey, do you figure you can get me a real nice cuckoo clock at some kind of discount? Let's talk about that during this radio show. And now he keeps wondering why Jason Bourne won't turn himself in if he didn't do nothing bad. I wonder that, too. Colin McEnroe.
All right. That's not exactly what happens in Stranger Things, which is if something can be a hit on Netflix, which is something that we are going to discuss, a hit on Netflix. This is set in the 1980s. As critic Dana Stevens called it, a highly citational movie, or excuse me, eight-part series. Very bingeable, quoting from all kinds of Stephen King folios and works of Steven Spielberg and Rob Reiner. It is the story of a group of boys, one of whom disappears in a very 1983 setting in Indiana, and the other boys are riding around on their banana bikes trying to figure out what happened to their friend. Meanwhile, a mysterious visitor with superpowers winds up hidden in one of their houses, concealed in a closet, engaging in kind of monosyllabic speech with words like good and bad being used a lot. And does any of this sound familiar to you? Does any of this sound like a movie you might have seen before? Well, anyway, this Stranger Things is a eight-part series, as we say, by the Duffer Brothers. And it is a lot of things that you've seen before. A lot of people seem to really like seeing it this way, retold this way. So joining us to talk about that and later on to talk about some scandalous, in several senses, reporting from Rio are Teresa Kramer, a writer and editor for eContent Magazine, and the founding editor of The Cut, an online magazine for disgruntled Connecticut young adults. You know, it's kind of hard to – if you just Google that, though, you get like the fashion thing from New York Magazine.
Yeah,
or
I didn't know
any,
that
like,
existed.
Sort of, do you have any SEO stuff for people who want to find like your The Cut?
I'll work on that.
Okay.
I'll work on that.
Yeah,
just put in like Hartford or something.
Yeah,
I'm sure we write
Hartford
about that.
Hartford, comma, disgruntled.
Yeah. That'll get a lot of hits.
I tried typing in Asian persuasion, The Cut, and I got like a whole bunch of websites that I was really sorry I didn't. Anyway, John Dankosky is executive editor of the New England News Collaborative and the host of the brand new Next, which is terrific, and which airs on Thursdays at 2 p.m., right? 2 p.m.?
2 p.m.
Yeah, 2 p.m. And he's also with me on The Wheelhouse at WNPR. Carolyn Payne is an actress, comedian, dancer, founder, cat herder, director, choreographer of Kinetic Dance. And if I tried to come up with all the other things that she is, we'd be here a long time. So let's just hear a little bit before we plunge in. This is – it's going to be the first clip for you, Wolfie. Let's just hear – this is Winona Ryder This is the opposite of an all-star cast. It's its headliners are Winona Ryder and Matthew Modine, and after that, it falls off very sharply. From Winona Ryder and Matthew Modine, it falls off sharply. Think about that. And this is from the first episode. Winona Ryder, as the mother Joyce, is trying to convince the disheveled Sheriff Hopper, a man in deep need of a wellness program of some kind, that her son Will is missing.
I have been waiting here over an hour, Hopper.
And I apologize again.
I'm going out of my mind.
Look, boy his age, he's probably just playing hooky. Okay?
No, not my Will. He's not like that. He wouldn't do that.
No, you never know. I mean, my mom thought I was on the debate team, and really, I was just screwing Chrissy Garvin during the back of my dad's old deal. So.
Look, he's not like you, Hopper. He's not like me. He's not like most. He has a couple of friends, but, you know, kids, they're mean. They make fun of him. They call him names. They laugh at him, his clothes.
His clothes? What's wrong with his clothes?
I don't know. Does that matter?
Maybe.
Look, he's a sensitive kid. Lonnie used to say he was queer, called him a fag.
Is he?
He's missing, is what he is.
When's the last time you heard from Lonnie?
Last I heard, he was in Indianapolis. That was about a year ago. But he has nothing to do with this.
Why don't you give me his number?
You know, Hopper, he has nothing to do with this. Trust
Joyce, me. Joyce, 99 out of 100 times, kid goes missing. The kid is with a parent or a relative.
Well, what about the other time?
What?
You said 99 out of 100. What about the other time?
Joyce.
The one.
Joyce, this is Hawkins. Okay. You want to know the worst thing that's ever happened here in the 4 years I've been working here? Do you want to know the worst thing? It was when an owl attacked Eleanor Gillespie's head because it thought that her hair was a nest.
Well, much, much worse things involving sticky monsters are about to happen in lovely Hawkins. So, Teresa Graemer, set this up for us a little bit more. One of the things that's happening here, this, at least among a certain subset of the American public, this really has become a thing. And a lot of people are watching it. A lot of people are enjoying talking about it after they watch it. There's some way in which people are grooving on Stranger Things. Do you have any theories about this?
I think it's probably all about nostalgia. It's a good enough show, but it's not so amazing. You're not like, oh, did you see what happened on Stranger Things? It's more about you just being like, oh, look, that's from The Goonies, or that's from E.T., or I loved that, or like, I literally saw a towel that I still own that I took from my parents in the movie. That's from probably, like, you know, 1983, apparently. So
no, it's actually your towel. They came. Yeah. That's one of the unusual things that Netflix is doing. They're taking stuff from people's houses and then putting them in their shows.
That's a wonderful idea because we'll watch. We'll be like, oh, that's my jewelry box. But yeah, so it's all about nostalgia. One of the podcasts I listened to that was talking about it, you know, she was like, their fashion is on point. I totally wore those roughly necked, high sort of, I don't even know how to describe them, shirts. And they're like, and even when you were a teenager, you look like a 40-year-old secretary. Like, it was great. And it's just people being like, yes, this is what life was like in 1983 for me.
But so many people watching it weren't even, like, I have no, 1983, I was one.
Well, not 1983, but 1989
yeah.
wasn't that different,
yeah,
right?
True. Yeah, true. But I do think, like, it's preying also on the nostalgia of the films from them. Because, mm-hmm. like, for me, right. my memory of the 80s is mostly created by things made in the 80s that I'm watching. And I think for a lot of people watching Stranger Things, it is kind of... It does. It has that Goonies vibe. Mm-hmm. I also got like a huge X-Files vibe from this. Like those early episodes, it all felt like some big setup. Like I kept waiting for like Mulder and Scully to pop in and help take care of this. Mm-hmm. But I think it is. This is the summer of nostalgia for the 80s in so many ways. Like Ghostbusters and I feel that vibe all around.
See, when we were talking about this online beforehand, I never got into the Goonies because I like was the Goonies. This is like yeah. exactly right in my sweet spot. Mm-hmm. In 1983, I was 14 years old. So I was a little older than the boys mm-hmm. and I was a little younger than the older sister. And I played Dungeons and Dragons. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, there weren't a lot of girls around. Mm-hmm. but I mean, I see everything about what my life was like right down mm-hmm. to the way the houses looked and mm-hmm. the style of carpeting and what was in my sister's room and what was up on the walls in my room. And It's just pitch perfect. And I can't – Colin, we were talking about whether or not the show's any good. I can't even tell you. I don't know if the show's any good.
I can.
It's just it's incredibly detailed in the way it documents what it was like to be alive at a certain time of a certain age, kind of in the middle of all that. There's no nostalgia for the films for me in it. It's my life.
I mean, I think it's not a good series, but I also get that, that we enjoy things that are not necessarily good. Things can be really, really fun if they're not.
I think Carolyn only enjoys things that are not good.
Carolyn really likes the Sharknado movies. So let's...
I do. They're great.
So yes, I mean, Carolyn is living proof that we can all enjoy things. But we can all enjoy things that aren't particularly good. And I think that's sort of what's happening here. The one thing that I do that worries me a little bit, if that's the right way to say it, is, I mean, there's nothing wrong. I mean, artistry often occurs when people take other people's themes and play on them. But this isn't Charlie Parker playing Richard Rodgers. It's more to me like a tribute band, you know, in a mid-sized bar that really these two guys, the Duffer Brothers, they don't really have any original ideas. I mean, everything in here is a fundamentally unoriginal idea that's not particularly improved upon. And, you know, and if you really want to nerd out on this the way Jonathan McNichol has been doing, I mean, yeah, they're like at the level of fine detail, things are copied. And, you know, I just came to episode 6 where we learn a little of the backstory of this kind of semi-magical creature. This little girl who's been living in somebody's closet, been hidden in somebody's closet, and as the person watching it with me pointed out, it's Firestarter.
Yeah.
It's exactly the backstory of Firestarter. And I think the difference is that ultimately – this is not an original idea with me. Stephen Metcalf from Slate said this too, that if you think back to what Spielberg really was, you know, what these movies were – They had an incredible humanity and pathos to them. You know, they really were about people who had incredible stakes on the line. You know, recognizable emotional stakes too. I mean, you know, E.T. is about a bunch of kids whose family is coming apart and they get this little special friend who they're going to lose. And at the end, you know, if you can sit today through the moment where E.T. reaches his finger out and says, Elliot, be good. If you can sit through that without sobbing, you know, you are a better man than I. And I don't think this particular work of art has the capacity to make anybody sob. It's kind of a snack that you're eating.
Yeah, I think that you're absolutely right. It is a snack, but it's this – imagine putting together the most finely constructed snack of all time. And you have all of this detail in there. And what if the concept is just to be this detailed – photocopy of something that many of us lived through that the Duffer Brothers, by the way, didn't. I think they were born in the 1980s, so they don't have any original knowledge of any of this. It's nostalgia for them of a second hand, but it's just meant to hit tripwires for people who love the music or love the clothes or love some of those movies. I mean, I wanted to say one of the first things I thought about, because this is a quote-unquote horror premise set at this time, was my experience of that summer of Poltergeist.
Yeah.
Now, do you know the movie Poltergeist?
I do, yeah.
Okay, so the movie Poltergeist that came out, and I'm 14 years old, I was so scared by Poltergeist that I don't remember watching the movie. Mm-hmm. But I remember the night after I watched the movie as I played in my front yard and the sun was going down. And I remember thinking, I hope the sun doesn't go down because I don't want to go to bed because I'm so scared of the Poltergeist. Mm-hmm. That's how much that affected me at the time. And that's what I'm thinking about. And it's so good at that that the dialogue and everything else doesn't matter.
See, I'm older than you and I saw the movie Poltergeist with my then wife. But we happened to go to the movie in separate cars. So, and I drove a little faster than she did on purpose. And I got home and I opened all the drawers in the house and I put the dining room table chairs on the dining room table. And like I did so that when she walked in the door – I mean, this wasn't why we got divorced.
I was going to say, no one at the time wife.
She was actually kind of entertained by things like that. But I mean, but Poltergeist, which features a missing child who is communicating in a crackly way through transmissions on other kinds of devices, I mean, is once again evoked with so little change.
Well, this is a movie.
Stranger Things, yeah.
This is a movie for fanboys, right? Yeah. I mean, it's a movie basically made for the kids who are in the, like those characters in the movie are grown up now and they're watching this. You know, they're kind of nerdy little kids who just like to play with in the audio visual room and Dungeons and Dragons.
In a basement.
Yeah. Right here.
And you know, if they grew up now, they would totally watch this. That's what it's all about. I mean, it's it's not made to be great cinema. It's made to just be like, to dude.
It is very watchable. Yeah. I will say that. And I actually, I know some people online were, you know, giving her a hard time, but I thought Winona Ryder was amazing in this. To be honest, I think this is one of the better things she's done, because she kind of, you know, made a career at being able to play unhinged really well. Mm-hmm. And I think I had said this in an email, like the first scene that you see her, I was just kind of slammed with like, oh, my God, when did Winona Ryder become this middle-aged frumpy woman who may as well just be on that sitcom The Middle? Like at first I just couldn't get past her being older. And then I really started to buy into her as a character. And I really thought her performance like anchored this for me, which I was excited for her because, you know, I think that this is a good vehicle for her as an actress.
It's a good vehicle for her. I mean, it's kind of a one-note performance, as all of her performances have been. And so it's not as though she's stretching herself.
No, yes. But I did think she was better in it than, you know,
well, she's
like
great
Mr.
At being...
Deeds or something. That's the last thing I can think
she's
of.
She's great at being hysterical and annoying, which is what she, you know, like...
Right.
They might as well have just written
they found the note that she can
annoying.
Sing really well, and she blasts it the whole time. But I did think she was good at it.
See, perspective is so important, and it's so amazing to me, Carolyn, to listen to you. I mean, we're miles apart on the age spectrum, so the idea that they frumped her up. I had kind of the opposite reaction, which is it's kind of like when they supposedly had aged and disheveled Elizabeth Taylor for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Mm. And I remember reading Mad Magazine saying, well, we wouldn't want our mother to look like that.
Yeah.
Our girlfriend, maybe, but not our mother. So, and Winona Ryder, to me, who plays this single mom living in a shabby house on the outskirts of town, next to the really scary government plant, and with a crummy job in retail, which is kind of funny all by itself, but with a crummy job at a store where she works long hours for very little remuneration and smokes lots of cigarettes. To me, Winona Ryder, who in real life is 44 and a very youthful 44, I think she's not as ravaged as I would expect that person to be.
No, and I think she's supposed to be a relatively young mother.
I mean,
she's got a 16-year-old, or what, he's got to be almost 18 or something
who?
Like that.
Oh,
the
yeah,
older
the
one.
The older boy, he's 17 years old, yeah.
Right, so if
I guess just the thought of her having a 17-year-old was jarring to me because, you know, I still think of her as like...
Well, Joyce gets started early.
Yeah, I guess so.
Let me ask you, a discussion did ensue online that I thought was very interesting about just sort of the notion of childhood adventure, that one of the things that we're seeing here that was perhaps also part of John's 1980s banana bike childhood is just little boys running around essentially unsupervised, going out in the woods. None of these kids has a karate class or a Mandarin Chinese class they have to go to after school. They're not enrolled in soccer programs. Instead, they're just making up their lives the way they want. And I don't know, all of you had sort of very – first of all, John, was that also a familiar thing to you as opposed to the helicoptered life of today's children?
Oh, my goodness. No, so we had acres and acres of woods out behind our suburban house. And we could just wander into the woods as long as we wanted for days on. In the summertime, we would start early in the day and we would go all throughout the day. And we'd find secret caves and we'd find bogs and marshes and we'd take gigantic hikes. Now, we thought that this was as big as all of Pennsylvania, but it was like an acre, right?
Yeah.
But we felt as though we were constantly on this adventure. We'd find Playboy magazines that someone had hidden in the woods and we would make up stories about things. This is exactly what it was like to live in the suburbs. Outside of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, 1983.
Yeah, I grew up fearing the suburbs and and rural areas. I grew up in Boston. We eventually then moved to Newton, which is not at all. It's a suburb, but it's not really. So I kind of grew up seeing things like this, movies like this, and thinking like, all right, well, the suburbs is where all the bad stuff happens. Like you go wandering off in the woods to play with your friends and somebody never comes back. I had developed this intense fear of wooded area. And still to this day, like living in Connecticut, if I'm driving at night through a dark country road, I feel really ill at ease. I would feel safer in a...
but that is something that happened after that time. There became a fear of the suburbs as a place where you could get abducted or a jogger could go missing.
And I think that
we did not have that.
It
hadn't really happened in our lives.
That's, I think, the jump from like the early 80s to like the later 80s where, you know, kind of started participating in civilization and life, that you did have that fear because of, you know, like the John Walsh, America's Most Wanted. And I had friends who had deep fears of being kidnapped. And I never...
That came up in the emails, yeah. And I was surprised by that. I'm sure it's absolutely true, but that Adam Walsh might be a demarcation point, a psychological demarcation point for a lot of kids who grew up right around that time.
I don't feel that way. My childhood was much more like John's. My mom was just like, get out, come home for SpaghettiOs in a couple hours, and then like,
I was allowed outside.
But, yeah.
but I mean, it was just not, you weren't running off into wooded areas.
We didn't have an acre of woods, but we had like little patches of woods like you'd cut through to get to someone else's house or something, or we'd spend all day sledding. And I don't know how we survived that, honestly, when I think back on that, because I've banged into more trees than anyone should be allowed to and still be alive. But if you went to the neighborhood I grew up in now, it would still be like that. Where if you went to a much more affluent neighborhood, it would not be like that. It's mostly because the parents cannot afford all of those programs and don't have time to watch them all the time. And they're just like, yeah, just walk down the street to whoever's house and leave me alone for 10 minutes, please. You know, and the school is right in the middle of the neighborhood, so no one has to walk more than 10 minutes to get to school, kind of thing. And everyone is doing it, which is the difference now, right? You go to like a fancy neighborhood, everybody's kids at soccer practice, so none of the kids are allowed outside because there's no other kids. They can't travel in packs and be safe.
But kids,
you know,
are going outside, yeah, this summer thanks to Pokemon Go.
Yeah. Right.
That's right. It took that intervention. So I do want to say that I actually think you're all right. You're all correct in different ways, because I think this isn't so much pegged to one particular thing like Adam Walsh or John Walsh, but pegged. It's instead an eternal battle. You know, for as long as there's been civilization, certainly for, you know, the last 100 years in America, there's been a battle between children who want to go out and play in the woods and various ideas about what else might be there. I mean, it's embedded in our fairy tales, after all. I mean, it's Little Red Riding Hood. And I certainly grew up in a neighborhood that looked like Steven Spielberg had designed it for one of these movies. It had a patch of woods at the end of a street. There was literally a huge house, like a 30-room house that two people lived in, but they were caretakers. They didn't, you know, and there were woods. And then for a while, we couldn't go in the woods because there was this guy called the Green Man who was going around essentially raping people in their houses. And so because of the Green Man, we were all kind of pulled back away from the woods, and we thought it was all kind of stupid. Much later, it turned out that Albert DeSalvo, before he became the Boston Strangler, was the Green Man. That was kind of his early, you know, and he was operating in Connecticut. And so our parents were completely right about this. But I think this is a battle. You know, it's an eternal human battle. Mm-hmm. Who gets to go in the woods? Who gets to go out and have adventures?
Well, you know, that clip that we heard where the cop is trying to explain that 99 times out of 100, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Well, see, the town I grew up in, it was a suburb, and almost everyone there was an engineer. The dad was an engineer, and the mom, my mom, was she worked in a hospital. So they were both science people. And so for them, 99 times out of 100 is good enough to go let your kid out.
Right.
For a lot of people, it's not. But in my neighborhood, everyone just assumed, oh, you're probably going to be safe because statistics show you're probably going to be safe.
Just send them out with 100 kids in a pack of 100 kids and hope they're not the one.
Well, and that's the thing. There's always going to be one, but yeah, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's – we also live in an age where we're just constantly bombarded with the thing, with these things. Like I will be endorsing later some podcasts where they talk about a lot of murders, and this has been going on forever, right? People have been getting abducted and killed and murdered not by creepy creatures.
Not by sticky monsters.
Not sticky monsters that live in an underworld, but by other weird monsters, mostly humans. And we're just bombarded with it now, and we're all like, you know, riddled with anxiety. So we're like, well, what if my kid is the one kid and I didn't do the thing to keep him safe? And so
I've got a couple of other things that I want to talk about too. And Caroline, one of the things I think you are kind of an expert on is the way people do enjoy something like this that's not necessarily high art, maybe not as low as Sharknado, but you know, there's a way in which like I think one of you, it might have been you, Caroline, found like a Tumblr or something that's devoted to this very minor character who disappears pretty early. There's, you know, somebody else was sending out this kind of 8-bit emoji of this amusingly toothless kid who's one of the four protagonists. You know, there's a way in which once you realize that this isn't Citizen Kane, you know, you can start to have fun with it at a sort of lower stakes level.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that when a show like this with Netflix, where it isn't on a network, I think one of the things that gives it traction is, you know, when it becomes part of this social media BuzzFeed culture, mm-hmm. and then everyone starts feeding into that. The first I had seen this show like pop up as a suggestion on Netflix, but I hadn't watched it yet. And then I started seeing and my roommate cheated on me and watched it without me. And I was filled with rage. And he was watching it because he saw all these people posting about the wig that they put on. The character L, and you know, and he's a gay man, and all these gay men and hairdressers were like, "Where did she get this lace front wig? Where did these 12-year-old boys find this perfect, flawless wig to get on her? And why did this boy know how to do makeup?" And
it was in the costume bin, duh.
Right? But like, your Halloween wig does not look like that. Like, it's you know, all spazzy. And so, I mean, when something latches on and gets cultural traction, where people are talking about it on a level like that, it then draws people in to watch it, and I think it changes the way you watch it, because my first, you know, my first sites for this were about this like wig scene and all these other kind of like ridiculous, like the Barb character. So you're introduced to it in such a weird backwards way.
Well, Barb is basically Martha Plimpton from Goonies, right? She's the sort of frumpy friend who is like, "Why are we doing this?" Blah. And
she is like, "Why you don't want to be the frumpy friend?"
Yeah, and
the,
so
the tag along who's not, you know. But back to your point, John, this is a series so much about curation. Mm-hmm. You know, it's about the physical and nostalgic curation of the past. So it's not a big surprise that people start nerding out, you know, about whether it's the right wig or not.
Well, it's strange that the wig is something that actually I of course never would have thought of the wig. But there's many other things that I have been seeing in this, and I don't know. I think that some of those details, because they're so right, after the course of about four episodes, then you start to see the things that are all quite wrong and where some of the styles don't exactly mesh up, because you're hit with all this nostalgia at once, and then you realize there's some things about the dialogue that they don't get right. I mean, mm-hmm. I will just say that if you trailed around a bunch of 12-year-old boys in 1983, some of the words they say are the words that were said in the show. But there are an awful lot of words that you can't put on a show right now that the boys would say over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And they were really unfortunate choices. We didn't make good choices about the way we talked about things. And there's a lot of homophobic language that was used by 12-year-old boys in 1983 mm-hmm. that probably, if you were going to make an homage to that time, it would be laced throughout this the conversation. So there's some things that get kind of wrong that I'm noticing more as I go.
Mm-hmm. I'm told I'm allowed to bounce one more idea around the table before we go to break here. I think the idea I like to bounce around is the notion of this being a hit, Teresa. One of the things that's complicated, and I did share some links about this with you guys, is Netflix doesn't really actually release audience numbers. There's another startup company that claims to be able to kind of guesstimate Netflix mm-hmm. numbers. But it's sort of interesting because it is that unreliable metric of everybody I know. But like everybody we know, if we are a certain kind of person, mm-hmm. is watching this show. And maybe that's just enough to make it a hit, whether the numbers are hit numbers or not.
Well, You know, I was thinking about that because you mentioned that before in our emails, and I was like, I don't actually know that everyone I know is watching this. No one has actually spoken to me about it except for when you sent out this email and we decided to talk about it on the show. And I had actually told my boyfriend, who's a couple years older than me, and so he remembers the 80s better than me. And I told him, you're going to love this because he has an encyclopedic knowledge of all these 80s movies, and he, like, didn't watch it. And then finally the other night, right after we were talking about doing the show, he said, "Hey, did you watch this already? Because I'm like two episodes in now." And I was like, "Yes, I watched it, but I might watch it again." And he liked it quite a lot. He binged it. He stayed up till God knows what time and couldn't function the next day. But no one else has said anything other than I'm reading about it in the blogosphere, that I'm seeing stuff on Facebook, I'm seeing stuff, but no one I actually know has watched it. And so I don't know, you know, whether or not it's really a hit, I don't know.
I got the Katie Tolarski. Have you seen Stranger Things? I was like, sure. No. She always does this, and so I have to then watch it. But it's usually like one person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess I had a fair amount of people in my like circle of friends on Facebook who were watching it and over the past couple weeks. So I had seen those posts. But again, I don't know. Based on the people I know, I don't know if that's something that we can say, like, everyone is watching this.
But I think your point, Colin, is do we know through metrics in the same way we'd know about a big opening night mm-hmm. or, you know, movie preview? I don't know about that. And maybe part of it is just the machine that gets built up around this new type of binge watching. As long as enough people say that everyone's watching it, well, then it must be successful, right?
Right. And I do think, I mean, there's two things that happen. I think when something is just pitched perfectly – at a particular demographic. That demographic will find out about it. And so in our newsroom, where there are a lot of people kind of in the right age demo, it turned out just, you know, we mentioned it the other day that we were doing this show and heads swiveled around. And Lucy Nalpathanchel, Katie Tularsky, Heather Brandon, a whole bunch of people in the newsroom are all watching it. And the other thing is you don't want to be the conversational equivalent of Barb, too. If everybody that you know is talking about something, you absolutely, if you want to stay in the conversation, you kind of have to watch it. So that doubles down on the everybody I know phenomenon. All right. The show is Stranger Things. You can decide on your own whether to watch it or not. If you watch one episode, you'll probably watch the other seven because Netflix doesn't even give you much of a chance to opt out of binge watching. So anyway, we're going to come back. We're going to talk about something a little more serious. So the Olympics are always kind of strange, and this has maybe been an especially strange Olympics, some surprisingly inspiring moments. Whoever thought Michael Phelps would make us feel good about Michael Phelps again, but he kind of has. And then there have been some pretty horrible moments. Some of them we knew were coming in the run-up to the Olympics, but the Daily Beast, an online publication, kind of caught us by surprise. A story published by writer Nico Hines, who significantly is straight. It was a piece about dating and hookup apps being used at the Olympic Village. The Olympic Village, there have been other pieces of journalism in past Olympics about how the Olympic Village is kind of this enormous sex farm at one point, all these kind of attractive, agile, healthy people taking healthy and agile interest in one another. But Hines used apps like Tinder and Grindr to pose as an athlete looking for dates, and then he collected up his interactions, took away the names, but maybe not all the identifying information, and published a piece about how easy it was to find people willing to engage in casual sex among the Olympic athletes. It has caused an enormous stir. The Daily Beast has ultimately kind of backed away from it. First of all, they re-edited the piece and put an editor's note up there, kind of semi-standing by the story. And then last night, they took the story down entirely. They've replaced it with I think, pretty abject apology for ever having done it. So, John, I'm going to have you kick things off as the journalist who is the most outraged by this, although everybody on the panel is completely outraged by it. So, yeah.
And look, we're probably all outraged for some of the same reasons. As I read the retraction or whatever, the note from our editors, which ends with the words, "We will do better," I thought to myself, we will do better what? Mm-hmm. The next time we decide to tell a story that doesn't matter, we will tell it better. The next time we endanger people's lives or their identities or even just some of their personal freedoms, we will do better. The notion that this was an assignment that anyone would take, given Colin's setup, that yes, there are a bunch of attractive athletes from around the world who may indeed engage in sex with one another. That is news. How? Mm-hmm. I just from the start of when the first person had the pitch to say this is the story I want to do to this horrifying note that they put up in order to retract it. It is just a train wreck from start to finish. And I can't even – in this, they say, we did not uphold a deep set of the Daily Beast's values. I have no idea after this what those values are.
Mm. Yeah, one of the first questions I had was, why do they need apps at all, the athletes? You're just surrounded by good-looking people who will probably have sex with you. So what are you doing with apps?
Year after year, you hear how they run out of condoms.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I was like, is it really that hard? Why are you bothering with Grindr right now? But then
– Well, you can fish in a bigger pond.
Yeah, you can. But why would you want to when you have Olympic athletes you could be having sex with?
Well, I mean, it also – I mean, I suppose Grindr and Tinder allow you to separate sheeps from goats or however you want to –
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, if you're going after a particular kind of experience.
But then, the main horrifying thing, like it's never good for journalists to be outing people, unless maybe they're a politician who is actively sort of campaigning against gay rights or something like that. But in this case, as you mentioned, they literally endangered people's lives because these were not people in the United States. These are people from countries who are not necessarily very gay friendly, and in some places it's literally a crime to be gay. So I mean just the complete lack of human decency in this story is a forget journalism, you are a terrible person for doing this story.
I was just flabbergasted that this even who came up with this and then and pitched it, and then everyone said, oh, this is going to be a great idea. Mm-hmm. it just – it was so slimy. And it's not really news. Like, we know these athletes are partying. I remember reading an article a couple Olympics ago about how, you know, once they are done competing, I mean, they are – it is just a free-for-all party. And you know what? They deserve it. Yeah. You go and do whatever you are going to do. You slam into those other athletes, like, drink all you want. I don't care. And this just was so – It just felt unnecessary and really I was so grossed out when I heard this and saw and I was relieved to see so many people outraged on Twitter.
Okay, so since I'm the host, I have to do the thing where maybe I try to find a counter argument here.
Oh,
although I'd much rather be sitting around the table with you.
Here we go.
Well yeah. Since I have to do that,
yeah.
The counter argument I maybe would try to muster would be the one that sort of says, and I would say, by the way, this would be at the pre-conscious or subconscious level on the part of the Daily Beast, its editors, its writer, but that maybe it plays out this way anyway, is that we live in a world full of apps and other kinds of electronic devices that we don't really understand very well. We use them. It's like we were driving every day across bridges that have never been inspected by anybody since their completion. We don't know how they work that well. We are taking tremendous risks quite frequently when we're using them. The risk that you take when you use Tinder and Grindr outside the Olympic Village is still pretty high, right? You're going to be – you could be running into a sticky monster or something along those lines. You don't always know. And one of the things that comes out of this piece in the most horrid way possible, obviously, and damaging and risky to the athletes who live in countries like Tonga where, as everybody's saying, it's much more dangerous to be gay than it is here. Not that it's risk-free to be gay in this country either. But one of the things that comes out of this is you have to be more careful. You absolutely – these are not safe devices. In this case, you were being very easily trolled by an unscrupulous reporter from perhaps
an
unscrupulous site.
The show Catfish on MTV and the original documentary film, they've already taught us that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this we have tons of information that shows that in a safer way that sends that teaches that lesson.
I mean, I think we know, right, that we're being watched all the time as anytime we're using one of these devices. And if you don't know that, you should know that. But we don't expect that a journalist, someone whose profession it is to inform us, to go and use that to their advantage in a really sticky, slimy, gross way. Now, yeah, you may go out on a Tinder date and get murdered. That's the risk you're taking. But you could – but – you don't assume that one of those risks is that a journalist is going to invade your privacy.
Well, and from the journalist's standpoint – you can't make the assumption that this, just because it is a story that is available to be told, mm-hmm. is a story that should be told. I mean, mm-hmm. we kind of have a thing. It's not too dissimilar from what doctors have, which is do no harm, right? Mm-hmm. We're just supposed to think about it before we tell the story, which is why we sometimes don't use the names of people when we could use their names, because we want to make sure that they don't get into a bad situation afterward. This is one in which, from the start to the end, there was only going to be harm.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to go undercover, if you're going to use not your real name, there is a list as long as my arm of things that are wrong with the Rio Olympics, from the way the stadiums got built to the public corruption that happened around them to the quality of the water. If you're going to go undercover, go try to figure out why some people living in a slum outside of Rio are still living in that condition after this big thing comes there. Don't do this to try to figure out how Grindr is going to work for a bunch of teen handball players from some country where it's not really okay to come back to a story that you're gay. That's mm-hmm. just not good journalism. And as you said, it's just being a terrible person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it does seem that the Daily Beast you wonder if people can learn from things. And if any good could ever come out of as flawed a concept of this, maybe the good would be, well, you know, this could have been the Tonga secret police, you know, checking out what you, Mr. Swim, are doing in the Olympic Village, and when you're from a country where it's not okay to do these things. So maybe everybody learns a little lesson about that it could be the Tonga secret police the next time you use Tinder or Grindr. Maybe be a little bit more careful. Make sure you're being smart about this. But the counter argument to that is the Daily Beast should have learned from Gawker.
Yeah, I was just about to say, didn't Gawker teach us this? I was on the nose when we talked about that. I cannot wrap my head around this situation. I have nothing to say. I'm actually speechless on something like this, that it could happen.
Yeah, I mean, just to remind people, so Gawker lost this huge judgment involving the publication of a sex tapes of a famous person.
Oh, I wasn't and even
A somewhat athletic famous person.
I wasn't even thinking about that because they had another thing where they outed, like, he was like a CEO or something, someone at some company.
Yes, that Peter Thiel.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Well, there's that too.
Yeah.
But I guess what I'm wondering, you
and
know,
he funded the lawsuit that bankrupted or that nearly bankrupted them. Yeah.
We were talking in the last segment about what makes a hit, right? Mm-hmm. Like, how do we know people are actually caring about Stranger Things? Well, what makes an article that you know is going to be something that people like or click on or whatever? Why is something – why do you decide to do something? We've got a lot of different reasons to do it. Mm-hmm. One could be, as you say, Colin, to try to teach us all a lesson. Maybe we can learn how to use this technology better. I'm going to bet that the first 1,000 things that they thought about were not that.
No. Mm-hmm.
And the 1,001st thing maybe was, but it was all about clickbait.
This is all about clicks.
It's all about clicks. And here's the thing. If it's all about clicks, who exactly is reading the article? Who's the person who wants this piece of stuff that we're making? And so if people want that and people want to click on that, then we maybe have to look at ourselves a little bit about whether or not that's something that we want to consume and stop consuming that stuff.
I think that was part of the confusion for me. Who did they think they were targeting that was going to get excited by finding out that, you know, some swimmer is gay? Yeah. Who cares?
Well, people will click on an article that says that other famous people are having sex. I mean, it just sort of works out that way. All right. We should probably stop there. But thanks very much for this discussion. We're going to come back. We're going to do a few endorsements.
You know, I only recently realized that Grindr was not a way to order submarine sandwiches, but, you know, when I did, it explained a lot of weird experiences that I had. Today's show was produced by Jonathan McNichol and me, Kyone Wolf. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. Katie Tolarski is our executive producer, and the part of Bill Curry was played by Matthew Modine. Don't miss an episode of our show. Subscribe at iTunes, Stitcher, or TuneIn, and like our Facebook page, The Colin McEnroe Show. On Monday, we'll be back with a sarcastic scramble. And now, back to Colin.
Yes, that's the other thing that I learned this week is that no matter what horrible or actionable thing that you've done, in fact, I don't know why the Daily Beast didn't think of just saying, oh, we were being sarcastic, because that is, of course, it's your get-out-of-jail-free card this week. I was being sarcastic. So I should have suggested this because near the end of our lengthy email discourses that spanned many days, we sort of started talking about like all the terrible TV that Carolyn likes to watch and then talking about the other terrible things that we like to watch. And I should have said all the endorsements have to be our own guilty, lazing on the couch or whatever the phrase was, guilty pleasures. But they don't have to be. Although, Teresa, you're going to take us halfway there with these podcasts.
Yeah, I don't feel guilty about this at the least. I love these things. I've been binging on them for like 2 weeks. If the NPR ratings have dropped, I'm sorry. That's me. I'm just listening to a podcast called My Favorite Murder, and it is in the comedy section, which is disturbing. But it's two women basically just talking about all their favorite murder stories. And if you are at all offended by people being funny and talking about sometimes like mass murders, you probably don't want to listen to it, but I think it's hilarious.
Who would be offended by that?
And strangely enough, there's another podcast called The Last Podcast on the Left, which is sort of the same thing, only they will also talk about like Bigfoot and conspiracy theories and stuff like that too. And
Who are the women on the first podcast? Are they comedians?
Yes, they're comedians. It's Karen Kilgariff and Georgia Hardstark. And it's kind of funny because Georgia's mostly into the murders so that she can figure out how not to get murdered. It's like an anxiety thing for her. And so listening to her talk about them is, I mean, they're very empathetic towards the actual victims, but at the same time, they're, you know, there's a cat roaming around making weird noises, and there's all sorts of other funny stuff going on.
You've actually succeeded in making me want to listen to this. Okay. And I feel bad. I feel bad about that, though. I don't feel good about it, but I do want to listen.
It's actually good. She got me hooked on it.
Okay. My favorite murder?
My favorite murder, right. Yeah.
Mr. Dankowski, what do you have for us?
Well, I will actually take you up on this sort of trip down memory lane and guilty pleasures, Colin, because, you know, we were talking a little bit about the music, and some people love the music in Stranger Things, and some people hate the music in Stranger Things, essentially, and you heard a little bit of a coming out of that segment. It's all synthesizers. It's bleeps and drones and very kind of spooky late 70s, early 1980s synthesizer sounds. And, you know, you might like that music. And if you do like that music, there's a real band. There's a real band that I loved all throughout my high school years. And the band is Tangerine Dream. Mm-hmm. And Tangerine Dream is an electronic band from Germany that went through many different iterations. But they actually, you know, connecting back to that, they did the theme music for Firestarter. They actually did the music for Firestarter and for Risky Business. Mm-hmm. No, not the big hit song in there. But they provided the soundtrack of so many early 1980s.
Two Michael Mann movies.
Michael Mann movies. There's a bunch of these.
Thief and Manhunter. Have you?
Yes, and from Flashpoint, they have a series of records before that though that are quintessential, you know, kind of German electronic music that guys who don't have girlfriends listen to in the 1980s. That was me, and I highly recommend anyone who loves Stranger Things and the music soundtrack. That's exactly what you need to go find. Everything from about 1970 through about 1988.
Actually, Guys Who Don't Have Girlfriends was John's tribute band to Tangerine Dream.
No one showed up at my gig.
Several people have suggested, they're like, you should choreograph something, create a contemporary ballet using that music from Stranger Things. So now I'm
I will so
that.
Score that for
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so maybe I will have to look into that. I actually was going to endorse cheesy, lazy couch watching TV. It's on Netflix, My Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. It is hilarious.
I've heard great things about that.
It is so funny. And the music in it is really fun. The songs are kind of, you know, there's things like about a song where it's like a yoga teacher, kind of her journey of being a ridiculous yoga teacher and just everything. Watch it. Listen to it. It's spectacular. And just crappy TV in general is my endorsement. There's nothing that's too bad to watch.
Binge without shame. I guess I thought that I will then – I've actually already endorsed this once. It was after our Tarzan discussion. But I have now watched the entire season of Animal Kingdom, which is an adaptation of an Australian movie in which Jackie Weaver, I think, was nominated for an Oscar for her fabulous kind of Jocasta meets Cruella de Vil characterization of this controlling, Oedipally inappropriate criminal mom. That is now Ellen Barkin in this series. She is amazing. She answers the question, what do you do when you've had too much much cosmetic surgery? You play somebody who has had too much cosmetic surgery, the kind of person who would have anyway. So she's great, and the series is stupid enough probably to make Carolyn happy. It has made me very happy in my lazy time on the couch. And I've got an extra minute. This is not exactly an endorsement because you can't really act on it right in a way. In fact, you missed your chance to act on it this week. But the next time you get a chance, I was up in Cape Cod at a writer's conference last weekend. And so Lyle Lovett was playing at a one of those musical tents where the stage slowly turns around, which are all very, very retro.
The Melody Tent?
They're the Melody Tent, yeah. And that's a great thing anyway. I mean, mm-hmm. It's really stupid, but it's a great thing. And probably very, you know, Stranger Things era in its conception. So anyway, I saw him up there. He also played right after that in New Haven. It was, you know, I mean, every once in a while there's sort of a concert that's a little bit more than a musical concert. It's kind of a spiritual experience. Well, I mean, a lot of the songs that he plays in concert are spirituals or gospel songs, or so there's that. But the way this man interacts with his musicians, and particularly with a large band, you know, what musicians, they sort of usually go, well, on drums we got so and bass over here and playing the trumpet we got. He doesn't do that. He stops at various times in the concert and picks out a couple of musicians and talks to them and tells their story. There's a guy he's got who played in some of the earliest Muscle Shoals ensembles and played alto sax with Jimi Hendrix before anybody knew who Jimi Hendrix was. I mean, this is such a gentle guy. So many of his musicians also have been with him since – one of these guys was rooming with him in the 1970s. A lot of these guys have been with him since the 1980s, since the setting of Stranger Things. And you just – the graciousness of this man. And his music is really – just fabulous too, but this ensemble that he plays with, which has four horns and you know, lots of other stuff along with it, this incredible gospel singer named Francine Reed, who tours around with him and has been with him forever. You just it's a musical experience, but it's also just kind of a lesson on how to treat people. You know, you can just see that he knows how to treat people. He knows how to.
That's
be
how
nice
he
to
got
be.
Julia Roberts to marry him. Well,
and it's a great endorsement. I mean, the endorsement, Colin, is really, and I have to just go see Lyle Lovett if you can.
Yeah.
Any in any form of his band. I've seen the small band. You just have to go see him. He puts on the best show. It really is.
I get to see him actually at the Bushnell with three other songwriters, John Hyatt, Joe Eli, and Guy Clark, who just died recently. In fact, Lyle's concert these days is a big tribute to Guy. But they each just played songs, and the other three would listen, you know? And then they'd talk about the song, and then they'd play another song. And that was amazing, too. So, yes, thanks very much to Teresa Kramer, Carolyn Payne, John Dankosky. We'll be back on Monday with a scramble, being really sarcastic in order to get out of trouble.
The whole cast of Stranger Things is amazing, but I gotta say, Winona Ryder totally steals $4,000 worth of clothes. I mean, the show. She steals the show. Show.